Good afternoon. Excuse me. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Cheryl Castile, and welcome to The Exchange. My guest in the studio today, Esther Tyree, is a musician, educator, writer, and a creator of wonderful culinary gluten-free delights. Many people in the area know her from a number of the bands she's played in, including Don't Pet the Dog, The Wildflowers, and with Dijleg and Black Bayou Constructs. So welcome, Esther Tyree.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here today.
It's good to be here.
Your life, it's interesting. Since I have known you and prior to me ever knowing you, but your life continues to evolve, which is something that
yes.
You know, that really draws, I think, myself and other people to you and evolves in terms of taking chances and risks in your life to, you know, I always see you as this person as you'll just grab whatever is out there in life and try to experience it so that,
yeah.
So that I can say I did.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair. And then several of my friends would say, and they've told me after something has happened, we knew you would do that because when you make a decision, you jump in and go for it.
That's right.
And that's kind of, yeah.
Well, were you like that when you were younger, when you were a teenager?
What, impulsive and tenacious?
Yeah.
Probably there would be some wild hairs. I would get my brother and I would be on the wall at my grandmother's property, and he would say, "Let's jump off and run in." Okay.
Yeah. Why not?
Why not? It's sand. What can you do?
You know. Now, life started for you where?
I was born in San Diego, California.
Yeah.
And don't remember living in different places, but we were in Mexico for a while. Excuse me. I think we were in Virginia for a while. And in Albuquerque, where my dad's family is, before we went up to Iowa, and we were there in Iowa for a couple of years. My dad was getting his degree in chiropractics. And
so were you of an age in Iowa that you remember?
I do remember.
There? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I remember falling.
Did he go to – was he in Davenport?
Yes, that's where we were.
At Palmer Clinic?
Yes.
Well, fabulous.
Yes.
That's like the home base.
Yes. My mom points back to Davenport. She said, "I taught you to skip, and I haven't been able to catch you since."
That's fabulous.
I point back to Davenport on ice skates. I was skating on the pond, and I fell and hit my head, and my mom sewed a pillow into my snowsuit.
So.
But, you know, I guess some of it would probably come from my dad because he and two of his classmates were looking at where they could go to set up a practice, and they came to Louisiana because at that time it was illegal to be a chiropractor in Louisiana.
Yeah.
So they were influential in getting the law changed to accept it in Louisiana as a viable and legal business.
Yeah, because he really – I mean, in a number of places as a chiropractor, that was difficult for mm-hmm. folks who were chiropractors back then.
Mm-hmm.
You
so
know?
They didn't want to go where it was already, you know, established and allowable. They
wow.
Said.
So yeah, let's go. Okay, so I get it.
Let's
that's
go to
where
Louisiana.
You get some of that.
And we came down, and he came down to visit. When
how
it was
old were you about when you moved here?
I think I was probably about five.
Oh, okay.
But they came down on a beautiful sunny day where there's no humidity and said, "We want to live here." And then we hit summer.
I was like, what the heck am I doing?
Yeah. We have those days where everybody wants to be in Louisiana. Oh, it's gorgeous here. Wait till summer.
Yeah.
And humidity.
So your dad – okay, that's great. So your dad was a chiropractor, and mm-hmm. now the music in comes from your
that
mother?
Comes from both sides of the family. My dad's dad played. In fact, there's this notion I have that my dad thinks I'm a little bit crazy. My grandfather was part of the original Grand Ole Opry and had the first music store.
Well, I didn't know that. Esther.
He had the first music store in Nashville. Well, when you go to the Grand Ole Opry, there's no record of Charlie Tyree. But there's a picture in a bluegrass, history of bluegrass, and this is when I first started finding out when I was in getting my grad degree in vocal ed at McNeese. We did an overview of American music. And so
yeah.
I did the bluegrass track because that's what I knew from my family. And my dad had just gotten some pictures from his twin sisters that we didn't know were there until a lot later in life.
Yeah.
And we went to meet them, and they started giving us information that we didn't know about my grandfather. But he had this picture, and he showed it to me. Well, I'm looking through this book for some information, and there's the same picture.
Wow.
And it doesn't list any names. It's just, you know, Roy Acuff and his band, the Fruit Jar Drinkers. Well, we were in New Orleans playing with Kevin Sacani for some showcase at the music store across the street from House of Blues. And there was a Charlie Poole disc set on the shelf. So I got it. And I'm listening to a song, and the next one comes on, and there's talking. And it's like my body just went, wait, that's my grandfather's voice. What is he doing on the CD? So I looked at it. I'm thinking, okay, well, Charlie. And there's just interesting coincidences between when my grandfather left and when, you know, Charlie Poole died under mysterious circumstances in 1931, the same year that my grandfather left and never went back, never supported my dad in playing his music. When we came along and we were playing, we were in the classical tradition.
Wait, so that was your grandfather?
So we don't know. We don't know how to proceed to get any proof, but I took it without telling my sister or my brother anything. I played the song for my brother, and he hears the song, and he's like, that's Papa. And I went to visit my sister, and I showed her the picture, and she said, how did you get a picture of Papa? I didn't know he recorded anything.
Boy, that's interesting.
It's very interesting. On my mom's side, her parents didn't play, but they offered music in the schools. So she had violin and my uncle had cello. My uncle lives in New Orleans. So when we moved to New Orleans, my mom said, I want a quartet. There's three of us in the family. She plays violin. I want a quartet. So she put my brother on cello. He went to have lessons with my uncle, my sister on viola, and me on violin. And she had found out about this teacher, Doris Hansen, who had gone with
Is in which town you're in?
New Orleans.
In New Orleans, right? Okay.
They had gone.
And that's where your dad had his chiropractic?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Actually, in Metairie area.
Okay.
But Doris Hansen had gone with John Kendall and several other very high-profile music teachers in America, and they had gone to check out Dr. Suzuki in Japan. What is this phenomenon of these kids at 4 and 5 years old can play these songs that we've always said were college-level substance?
Yeah.
Well, this teacher was there, Doris Hansen, teaching at Tulane. So my mom signed me and my sister up for lessons. Well, my sister, after about, I don't know, maybe 6 months, just was like, this ain't for me.
It's not her deal, yeah.
My brother said, this isn't for me. And I stayed with it, taking lessons with her. We'd go visit my dad's dad, and he would pull out his box guitar, and he'd play. And my mom's mom would come down to New Orleans for the Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Now, what you're talking about, your dad's dad, the Charlie?
Or mm-hmm.
Okay.
And my mom's parents would come for Christmas, and we'd all be at my uncle's house, and we'd all be playing music.
Yeah.
My sister went to piano.
What about your father?
He can pick up anything and play. He's a lot like his dad.
Okay.
He doesn't like to because he doesn't think that, you know, he does very well with it. And we're always just like, Dad, you know, you play the guitar, you play the mandolin, you play the piano. He would sit at the piano and he would just do these up and down, just playing.
Hmm.
And it was just really nice. So we grew up around a lot of music, and it was very much supported and very much encouraged. Probably why I do roller derby now, because growing up, we weren't allowed to play sports. You know, I mean, imagine you have a musician mom and a chiropractic dad, and they're looking at hands and necks going, no.
No, that's right. That's right.
My brother really wanted to play football. You play music and I'm a chiropractor. No.
Boy, that didn't work.
No.
It didn't work for at least their daughter.
And now my dad and my
gutsy
mom just go, Esther, Esther, Esther.
I want to back up to your grandfather. So when you would get together with him, and is he still –
No.
He's not still living.
He passed away in the late – I think 96 or 97.
Okay. So when you were growing up and he would come, at that time you knew him as a man who had the music store in Nashville?
No.
Oh.
We didn't know anything about my grandfather. We just knew that – you know, I didn't even know he was from Nashville. He was living in Texas in this little town where he was the mayor of Purvis, Texas. And he built an electrical motorcycle and gave it to my brother. And he would send us pictures of him feeding the little foxes on his property. And my sister actually got to see him more than we did. I think she actually went and stayed with him for a little bit when my his wife, my mama, started getting ill. But he would come and we'd go visit him in Alexandria and he just would play and he'd have people over and they'd play. And I was too young to really understand what all of the music was. It for me, because I grew up in that environment, that was just natural for me.
Yeah.
And natural for our family to have music. He was the one that gave him my fiddle. And my speculation, and it's just speculation, is that because I was in the classical tradition, he didn't see any threat of exposure if he actually had run away from Nashville to hide out in the back desert. That I wouldn't be the one to do that because I was in the classical, you know, venue of music. But it's interesting because he gave me my fiddle, and I was at college, and at one point I just told my mom, I said, I don't like it. I want a name brand fiddle. I want a name brand fiddle. So she found one for me, a Klotz. Her fiddle is a very old one called – it's made by, I think, one of the students of Stradivari. Guarneri, made in 1791, and her dad found that for her. So she found me this fiddle, and I took it, and I was at college and blah, 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 blah. And at some point, I was just like, no, I like my grandfather's fiddle. And that's what I play now, and it's –
And you still have – that's the one you're still playing.
And I still have it. Yeah, that's the one I have here. And it's interesting because it was made the same year that he left Tennessee, the same year that my aunts were born.
Wow, interesting, huh?
It's very interesting.
Isn't it something when you go back and you get the whole family history?
Yeah.
And what year was that when that fiddle was?
1931.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
And when we finally found out about my aunts and went to meet them, one of them had never, ever met her dad. Hmm. And the other one did, but she had to go to Kentucky to visit him. Like he never set foot back into Tennessee again, ever.
Huh.
So when I read about Charlie Poole dying under mysterious circumstances in 1931, it's like there's just way too much.
That's really interesting, isn't it?
Well, and the fact that the only Charlie listed in the Grand Ole Opry is Charlie Poole. There's no Charlie Tyree.
There we go, folks.
There we go.
And thus, that's...
There's a book in there somewhere.
So you did you major in music in college?
That would have – well, my first major was I'm going to go as far away from music as possible.
Really? Do you remember why? Why you wanted to do that?
Because I think I was running from just life and don't be pigeonholed into being a violin player. Just go do something else.
Yeah.
So I went into art design. And then I got sick, and my parents brought me back here to Louisiana, and I came to USL for a semester, and I was in fashion merchandising.
Okay.
And then it wasn't until I think I was on Dialysis for a couple of years before I was visiting my grandmother in Michigan, and I just said, you know, I need to finish my degree. I have a talent to play music. I taught through high school. My mom gave me a couple of – she would get – families on the waiting list, and she just sent them to me to teach. So I need to go finish my degree and get an education. And I said, I just don't know how that's going to happen. And she says, well, you know, when your grandfather died, he left money for you to finish your education. That's a whole nother interesting story because
this is a different grandfather, though.
That was my mom's
parents.
Yeah,
that was, yeah.
Yeah. This was, you know, probably late June, early July of all scholarships are usually given out at that point. And my mom found out and she called me up and I called up the dean of Loyola and said, I want my daughter to come in and audition. And so she got connected with the music teacher there. And I went and played for her. I hadn't played in a couple of years. And she said, you have good training. I'm going to recommend that they give you whatever they have. And so there I was enrolled in school.
Yeah.
And it was a really neat thing. You know, New Orleans is just – a neat place. I've encouraged several students here that I've met go. I mean, the professional musicians in New Orleans are very much involved, at least when I was, and they go between UNO and Loyola. And I know Loyola now has one of the best state-of-the-art recording studios on campus.
Yeah.
And when I went, they had just – I think their new music building had been open, I don't know, for a couple of years. But it was a neat experience. It was hard. It was difficult. I was sick at the time. I was on dialysis. But it was invaluable, the theory training and the the music history. It was just very fascinating. The orchestra experience, that's where I went through all the methods classes and ticked off a lot of my colleagues because of learning the Suzuki method, I could play by ear. So, and then I think probably because of my dad being the same way, I probably got a little bit of that skill as well. So I can pick up anything, and once I figure out the mechanics, I can play a simple tune. Well, that's all you need to pass your pass your little exams in your methods classes is just be able to play a scale and a simple tune. And I could, so I wouldn't have to practice.
Yeah. So it sounds like at that time you kind of went back to enjoying, like an enjoyment of playing music mm-hmm. when you were in school?
I did. I think my true enjoyment came when my friend Sarah and I went to the Mark O'Connor Fiddle Camp in 97 in Tennessee. And it's a week-long camp, and it just was amazing.
Did you have to get accepted to that, mm-hmm. or you can just
no,
– okay, anybody
just
can sign
up and
okay.
go. And it's just a really cool camp. I don't know that they –
And how old were you then? I mean, were you a teenager or adult? Mm-hmm. No, you were an adult.
I was an adult.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had my transplant, and so I could go and travel again.
Yeah.
But we went, and so much fun. Michael Doucet was there that year, and you could go and you could take any sort of class – and sit in with swing fiddle, jazz fiddle, Acadiana, Cajun fiddle, Texas-style fiddling, whatever. There'd be jam sessions. They brought in the musicians that Mark O'Connor was collaborating with to do shows in the evening. And
wow.
You're just there at this campground. It was just amazing.
With brilliant people.
Yeah, and at that point I was like, you know, I am a musician. That is a gift that I have, but it's not. I can teach the classical. I enjoy it. But for me to be able to move and to play the folk music of this area or in America and the fiddle music and just that was really what turned it around for me and allowed me, I think, to grow as a musician is to accept or kind of find, I guess, my niche, so to speak.
So, yeah, and I'm always curious about this, too, with fiddle players, with violin players, the – instrument you have with you today,
mm-hmm.
you refer to that as a
fiddle,
but
I also refer to it as a violin.
Yeah. So the difference between can you pick up your fiddle for a little bit?
I can. Well, and I even played as a mandolin, which is kind of funny.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit of that in a minute.
Yes.
I'm curious though with if you were playing a Suzuki-style method, you know, that you learned violin or playing mm-hmm. classical violin, it would be the same instrument.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
a different
it's
sound.
Just a matter of styling and how you move your fingers and up and down.
Probably one of the easiest ways to understand would be to consider it like a dialect. A person from New York is going to have a different dialect from somebody in Boston. You can understand them both, but
same
they have
voice,
the different
–
same voice but different accent.
Yeah. So the same structure but a different – can you play a little bit of classical for us first?
I can.
With your first
– what level of difficulty do you want?
As difficult as you can do it because we're live on the air, so make it good.
I have to figure out what to do with this headphone. Let's see.
That would show kind of what your roots were.
I really do want to do. There's a Bach E major partita. Let's see if I can stumble through a little bit of it. Anyway, that goes on for 3 pages, nonstop.
3 pages. There you go.
And I actually played that for my recital when I got my master's. And I can't play it. It's been a while. It's a lot of fun. And what's interesting is when I was learning it at Loyola, my teacher there, Valerie, she said, you know, Bach was very much in his writing like a fiddle. It was very fiddly in style. There's songs that we have in the literature that have parts that sound very much like a fiddle. There's a if I can get where it goes. on and on and on.
But that
and
would
sort
be
of Boeing.
That was part of a classical piece.
That's part of that Bach Partita.
Wow. Okay.
That's like down that first page. I think it actually goes four pages. But it's very fiddly, and I think that's what appeals to me about those classical writers. But what she had said was at that point in the history of the violin, there really wasn't any distinction between classical and what the folk music was.
Okay.
The distinction was between sacred and secular, where you had your sacred music and then you had your music that they would play for the dances or the balls.
Sure.
Or for the barnyard or for the porch.
Yeah, yeah.
We're called porch barbecues.
Yeah. Okay. No, I had never heard it put that way about that instrument.
So, of course, and then there's the very colloquial expression of the violin uses catgut strings and the fiddle uses the whole cat.
And that's all you need to know.
And that's all you need to know.
Right there. Can you play us when you – just something that maybe is reflective of when you really started listening to and learning and playing folk type of music?
Well, the ones that are very – that most people know would be Turkey in the Straw. Yeah. And then, of course, the Orange Blossom Special, which...
That's right. And that's very fast. That's when you're really showing it. I'm curious. You know, you have taught for years.
Mm-hmm.
And when someone comes into you to learn that instrument, especially at a young age, do people really know if... I mean, do you teach it as a whole instrument in terms of classical into folk music? Or do people specify this is...
I might ask them, you know, what their pull toward the violin is. Did you hear somebody play it? How were they playing? What style? But in basics, because I would take them as soon as they were potty trained
okay.
and start their training.
And would it be that Suzuki method or different? Okay, you would teach
and at
that.
The basic level, you know, learning to read to play by ear. And then learning to read is a very natural flow for kids. It's how we learn our language. And I think that was the innovative approach that was so appealing to the American teachers that Dr. Suzuki recognized, was that if all kids can speak their language by 6 years old, well, what's the process that does that? And then so why can't they play an instrument in the same manner?
Yeah.
And so he basically revolutionized how music was taught by introducing this idea that you would learn following the mother tongue approach. You would learn to play by ear and then – at a certain point, then you would begin to study the music of the masters, of other composers.
Yeah.
Where, you know, kind of in foreign language, you learn your language and then you can learn other foreign languages. So I've had kids that would come in and we'd start them with basic folk tunes because that's how the Suzuki method starts, just basic folk tunes. And then from there, they would say, well, I want to pursue the fiddle genre. And so then we would move into the fiddle genre.
Got it. Okay.
And they would learn to read and they would learn to play based upon that.
Okay. Okay. Your teaching that you have done for years, also with adults?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've taken adults. I've had adults come to me and say, I've always been fascinated, you know, by the violin. I think I'm too old. And I would quote Dr. Suzuki's statement of, you know, or actually I don't think he did. It was one of the other teachers here. They're rarely too young and never too old.
They're rarely too young,
rarely
and, never
too young
too
and never too old.
Yeah.
And it's true. You know, if you have your hearing and you have ability to move your hands and you still have your mental faculties, you can learn anything.
Yeah.
And so I would teach adults to learn and give them that. A lot of times they would come, for them, they'd had it as a younger child and were so intimidated by having to learn to play and learn to read at the same time.
Yeah.
And I said, no, we'll pull that out. You'll learn to play first where you can play several, you know, songs, functionally understanding technique and tone because the tone with the bow is very intimidating for some people who've not ever played a stringed instrument. Excuse me. And then after a while they get the hang of it and I'd say, okay, now you're ready to learn to read, but we'll learn to read using what you already know how to play, give you some awareness of how things work, and then we'll just, you know, spring on from there. So it's kind of a neat way.
That's right. You know, while you were teaching, I'm curious when writing came in for you, where you started, you know, because you spend a lot of time
writing music or writing
songs.
Songs.
You know, because you spent so much time teaching other people's songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're out there as, mm-hmm. as an educator, when did writing of music start for you?
I started journaling when I was sick, and that was a way for me just to express frustration or sorrow or anger or grief.
And just for writing.
Just writing in a journal. And that started probably in college, poems, writing poems. Things just started rhyming and writing poems. In fact, I found one that I wrote when I was at McNeese. It's like, I always wanted to put that to music, and I haven't figured out how to do it yet. And then when I moved here to Lafayette permanently, I woke up one morning and I had an entire song, chords and everything in my head. Before, I think I had some poems that I was trying to put to music, or I would have melodies that would be in my head, and so I'd have them to play, but no words. It was always separate,
mm-hmm.
music or words.
Yeah.
And when I woke up, it was like this melody was there and these words were there, and I wrote it all down. And it was really a very different experience for me.
Yeah.
But from then on, I would sit down to write in my journal, and it would turn into a song.
Oh, that's interesting.
Or it turned into a potential song.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've not been able to, except like for blogs and things, separate it out again back into music and words. The fiddle tune that I brought to Cecil, that's one. But there's still this part of me, it's like, no, there's got to be words for that somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Because we're going to listen to the Wildflower Stomp.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us more about that.
That was such an interesting experience. It's kind of in line of that, I want to do this, so let's try. I was listening to Caribbeas between students, and they were playing songs from not the Michaud Brothers. What's the other?
The Frère Michaud?
No.
I mean, the family?
No, the swing.
Red Stick Ramblers?
Red Stick Ramblers, okay. Their new CD. And they were playing a song from there, and I heard it, and I was like, that's such a cool song. And it's like, I want to write a stomp, a one-chord song. And so I just picked up the fiddle and started playing around with it, and I got these three sections of the song, and I took it to the band, and I said, what do you think? And they're like, we love it. It's like, okay, cool. And then my brother heard it, and he says, I want to do something with that. So he...
And this is your brother, John.
Yes, he added a bass line, and he added a drum track to it. And so now whenever I do it with my band now, that's kind of the model that we follow. He helped really solidify it into this sort of patterned tune.
Yeah. Well, let's listen. This is Esther Tyree and the Wildflower Stomp.
2, 3, 4. Thank you.
That was my guest today in the studio, Esther Tyree, and that's the Wildflower Stomp. If you're just joining us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at www.krvs.org. Make sure to check out the website for all kinds of great programs, both locally produced and nationally produced. We are a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Esther, that was a great song.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun to play.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of fun to write and then a lot of fun to play.
That was I'm curious, how old were you when you moved to this area of Louisiana?
I moved here. I graduated in 99-2000 and worked a year at Westminster in the high school for drama. 2001, I
back
went
in
to
New
England.
Orleans?
No, here in Lafayette.
Oh, here? Oh, okay.
I was coming through Lafayette to, and all the way to Lake Charles. And I had friends here.
Okay.
So I would stay here Thursday night, Friday night, and then go into New Orleans to teach and visit my family and then go back. And so I did that for two semesters. But I worked at Westminster in the theater department. My mom had gone to England that year. And she had met this family, and they wanted the little girl to do violin lessons. And so I wanted to go to England. My sister and I had said at our 10-year anniversary of the kidney transplant, we'd go hike.
Yeah.
Well, she –
because it was your sister who donated the kidney. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. She had just had a baby. It's like, okay, you can't go. I'm going by myself. So I did. I went to They're in Whitney, just outside of Oxford, and I went to stay with them for about a month, and then.
And you worked for their family teaching their child.
No,
violin? No,
I just went to visit them and got a bus pass and did the triangle out to Wales, up to Edinburgh, and then the youth directors at the church where I was going, they knew of a couple that had a theater company in Cornwall, so I emailed them and said, I'm going to be in England. I'd love to come see your theater company, what you're doing. And so I did. I went down there and ended up staying. It was funny because we had done Annie for the drama department had done Annie for the high school, and they were doing Oliver. So he just put me to work managing kids and braiding hair and doing stage makeup and wrangling them backstage. And after we were done the show, they said, we want to talk to you. And, what are your plans for work? We'd love you to come back and work with us. And so I came back here to Lafayette and then went back in February of the next year and was with them for 8 months working with the theater company.
Wow, what a great experience,
It
huh?
really was. It was so much fun. And we had a great time. I still keep in touch with them. In fact, my mom and I went in February this year for Mardi Gras. And one of the girls that was in one of the musicals with me is still there at Cornwall. Ah. And so I drove over to visit with her, and we just had a crack-up time laughing. But we had applied for a visa, and it wasn't approved. And so, I was just like, okay, well, if I go back to the States, I want to go to Lafayette. I really liked what was going on here. And I had, made some good connections with family. And the Merida Brooks, who is I think she's still superintendent for Westminster. She said, look, if you're coming back here, we'll find a place for you at the lower school in Lafayette. And so I was there for teaching music and subbing in the classrooms until the conservatory contacted me in January of 03 and said, we have room for a violin teacher, and especially a Suzuki violin teacher. You're interested.
Oh, and that's how you
got
with
them. I started there in January of 2003.
Were you playing music at all when you were in England?
Mm-hmm.
Did you? Were there?
Yeah, there's a picture somewhere of me. We did "Wind in the Willows," and I was the gypsy fiddler. And then I think we did a review of something, and I played. Yeah. So yeah, they fully utilized my skills.
Were there people, musicians, or style of music while you were there that you really wanted to seek out and learn while you were there?
I've always been drawn to the Irish and the Scottish fiddling, and probably because that's some of my heritage.
Okay.
I don't know that I heard a lot of music there. like live music,
sure,
or live musicians. It just working with the theater company and being involved with the shows, there wasn't a lot of opportunity to go out and see.
It took
much.
A lot of your time, mm-hmm. Yeah. So you end up back here in Lafayette and you're teaching.
Mm-hmm.
We're now moving into another chapter,
mm-hmm,
for you.
Yeah, a couple that came to do the orientation were put their twins in lessons on piano, and they said, "You need to meet our friend from Canada. She's coming for Christmas." And so they said, "We're going to be at a jam session when Mitch Reed had the..."
Oh, and this is Crystal?
Yeah, Crystal.
I didn't realize this is how you...
Yeah.
Meet... Okay.
So they said, you know, go to this jam session with us and meet Crystal. And so I did, and we were playing in the jam session, and she looks over and she goes, "I'm doing an American tour. I need a fiddle player. Are you interested?"
And that's Crystal Plamondo.
Crystal Plamondo.
Yeah, from Alberta.
And really, for everybody that I've played music with, she really was the one that got that started, because she and I went to the show that they did at Grant Street to raise money for the foundation at UL for the Cajun
for the
music,
Tommy Como?
The Tommy Como Fund.
Okay.
She and I went in 2004 to see the show.
I was with you that night.
Yeah. And
I forgot
the Lafayette
that.
Marquise were playing, and that,
yeah,
was Deej.
Yeah.
Well, then the next week, Christmas, he was playing at the show. And so I walked down after playing at 307 and had my fiddle and was like, "Hey, Deej, can I play a song with you?" And he's like, "Sure." So I got up on stage and played a song and went to get off. And he's like, no, stay up here." And afterwards, he's like, "Okay, you're drafted." I'm like, "Okay, what?"
So was Crystal, was that the first, like, band tour that you went,
mm-hmm,
on? Or had you, okay. Yeah, because that's a different experience,
mm-hmm,
than from when you're teaching. Mm-hmm. And
oh, yeah, it was epic fail. We were in New Mexico on stage, and I went to take my cello, and my bow hair popped.
Oh, no.
From the lack of humidity.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks like my violin went from, you know, humid weather, we like it, to dry, a high altitude, did not like it. So I remember going to play this one song, and this cloud of horsehair is just surrounding me, and I finished just playing it with the stick. I call my mom crying, "I don't know if I can do this." And oddly enough, Crystal came back and she says, "We're going to France. Come with me." Like, okay.
Yeah, so you did okay.
Yeah.
Let's listen. You brought in, so we're going to skip to the third song if we can with Crystal. And this is a song that you played on one of her original tunes, Like a, mm-hmm, Hurricane. Where did you record that
at? This was recorded with Tony Daigle at his studio, which is not very far from where I live. And I actually, like I said, made the suggestion to sing harmony. And I said, well, you know, she can always nix if she doesn't like it. But that's one of the things, when she heard it, she goes, "You sang on it?" She goes, "That's really cool." She said, "Thank you so much." So that was neat for me that I got to add in some harmonies for her.
Yeah. So this is Crystal Plamondo and featuring Esther Tyree on harmony vocals and fiddle.
Mm-hmm. I want to do what I want to do. I want to be who I want to be. I want to see who I want to see. Yeah, yeah. I'm sing with on my mat. I want to live in the light. I want to shout in the wind, cry in the rain. I thought you were the one who was causing no pain. Did my damn the generator can do. You rip my heart in two like a hurricane.
That was Crystal Plamondon, Like a Hurricane, featuring my guest in the studio today, Esther Tyree, on harmony, vocals, and fiddle. It's interesting that, I think a number of people now are recognizing you from, you know, not only the other bands you played in, but you really, you stand out when you play with Dij and with, you know, Black Bayou Construct. And it's great that that's how that connection happened from mm-hmm. watching him that night. When you're on stage with him, the style of music that he plays, I'm curious about how much, if that's been a lot of effort or work for you to play that style, or had you already been kind of fooling around with the style of music that he plays, because it's different from some of the folk you've been playing, and of course classical.
He labels it, you know, as the gypsy southern rock. It's fascinating because you've got five guys on stage that are just amazing musicians, and Holly Joe on the drums and Chad Willis on the bass, and now Chad Viator on the guitar, and they set this groove, and I can either play with them like some of the songs where we just have this strong rhythm. I can just, you know, do the bow back and forth to match the drum beat and the guitar. And then Dij just lets me go and, you know, play around the melody. He gives me these solos and rides, and I just get to play around the melody and just do crazy stuff. It's just a lot of fun.
And you're very physical. When mm-hmm. you're on that stage, we were all talking before the show in one of the recent performances you did for Downtown Alive. And it's not the only time that you've been up there, but you get up on top of the monitors,
mm-hmm.
which for – and you're a petite thing. That's a hike for you to get up there. But there's a very – but you're – it's very natural and comfortable looking when mm-hmm. you're up there.
I don't know when it started. I know with Don't Pet the Dog, we played Artmosphere, and I was climbing all over everything.
Ah, okay.
Mardi Gras, we were outside playing, and I looked up at the canopy, balcony, whatever cover, and I just said, I'm getting up there. And I got up there and just played. And, you know, I think it's fun for the audience to see that. It's like, it's not just music, but you're.
Is it a freeing thing for you?
And I think it is a freeing thing for me, too.
With no shoes on.
Yeah, I don't like wearing shoes. I invested in a wireless because having a wire and a cable was very detrimental to my health. And, you know, having insurance was a trip factor that I didn't like. So I got the wireless. And when I got the wireless, it was this whole thing of, you're not tied down. All these other guys are, and you're not. You can move. And I just started moving and roaming and climbing. And it was the more I climbed and the higher I climbed, the more excited the audience got and responded to the music. And so it just became this thing. And, you know, people will see me and say, why are you wearing your shoes still? Are you going to climb anything? And so that night when I saw those big speakers on the side of the stage, I told the sound guy, I said, you know, I like to climb. I'd like to get up on that speaker. Are they yours or are they the Downtown Development? He says, no, they're ours. And go ahead. And I said, okay. I said, there's one song that they do that I'm definitely going to climb. And so after the break, I was looking at one of the tops to the boxes, and he saw me look at it. He went and picked it up and he put it over there, and he found another box. So he made stairs for me.
Fabulous.
On the backside of the speaker.
And
so when I started moving to that, he came and he held my violin. I climbed up and he gave it back to me, and we just played away. And so it's neat, you know, when you have people who understand that you're not trying – I'm not trying to be a daredevil or to show off.
That's
it's
right.
just for me, it's just like, hey, you know, how high can I get?
But being a daredevil, can we – I think we do need to mention about your involvement with the Acadiana Roller Girls.
Yes.
And a performance you did do of the Star-Spangled Banner. yes. on skates.
Yes, they approached me to I'd been with the team since I think late February of last year, and several people knew that I play the violin, and so they mentioned me to one of the ladies that does bout production, and she says, would you be interested in playing the Star Spangled Banner for the bout? And I said, only if I can do it on skates. And they kind of looked at me. And they said, okay. So they said, you just have to have all your gear on. I said, not a problem. I probably should have it on anyway. So I have my mouth guard, my helmet, my elbow pads. The wrist guards made it a little bit, you know, tricky. But I skated around the track. And I told them, I said, if I can do it, I'll blow rosin dust in the opposing team's eyes and we'll win the bout. And we did. I think it was a pretty sizable win, too.
We were going to have you skate around the studio today
yes.
in here playing, but we didn't have – we've got the carpeting down, so that wouldn't have worked.
Right. And there needs to be sort of the ridges in the tiling so you can hear the wheels going.
And then Cecil, I think, got on the whole thing talking about – it would have been nice for you to maybe on a tightrope, all kinds of things you could do on a unicycle.
Right, on a unicycle, on a tightrope with a hula hoop.
Because as Cecil said, here in the part that we live in Louisiana, it's no big deal to be a really talented musician. You've got
right.
to have that
there's
extra.
There's just a bunch of us around here because you have to find your niche or your calling card or your trademark.
And let's put that challenge out to Walter
yes,
Pierce.
Yes, Walter Pierce. We want to see you at Downtown Alive on Friday playing that banjo, riding your unicycle. It's been said that you can do it.
So there you go. Not getting out of that one, Walter. On the unicycle playing the banjo, folks. Turn out this Friday for Downtown Alive.
The gauntlet has been thrown. I can only imagine what will be thrown back to me.
Well, listen, one thing I do want to talk about, because we are getting short on time, is because this is really, really interesting. But you started developing some physical problems.
Yes, I did.
That you noticed when you were playing violin, when you're playing fiddle, violin?
Well, it didn't manifest itself while I was playing, but at night my hands would go numb and they would be stiff the next day. So it was making it very difficult to play. And it was hard to demonstrate, you know, on the piano, the songs, or even just fast passages on the violin. And my fingers just felt very, very clumsy. And they were sore and achy from, you know, falling asleep and going numb at night. And I had gone to my dad and talked to him about it, thinking maybe it was something related to working at Edible Arrangements and rinding melons all day. And he had a friend sitting next to him, and she looked at me when I said, you know, my outside fingers, my pinky and my fourth finger on each hand. Excuse me. And her eyes got big, and she goes, mine are too. And I said, okay, well, you don't work at Edible, so it can't be that. It can't be job-related. So we sort of looked at what we had in our diet, and we had just waffles in common that we had for breakfast. So we both decided to eliminate it and see what happened. And so I had some relief for about a week or so, or maybe two, and then it came back, but this time on my thumb and forefinger of each hand. And at that point, I went back to my dad, and he said, well, you know, Esther, you do come from European heritage. And when I was in England, they were diagnosing kids left and right with gluten intolerance and celiac disease. So I was familiar with being gluten-free and that whole movement and awareness of health. He said, you just should go gluten-free and see what happens. And so I made the jump and just kind of cut it out of my diet and felt better. My hands weren't going numb, but I didn't realize how bad it was until – one of my seniors, he was going for his senior year to Interlaken, and he wanted me to come play a tune at his Boy Scout when he was getting his
Interlaken
Eagle badge.
Up in Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
He wanted me to come and play when he got his Eagle badge. And we played a fiddle tune, and most of the time in the past, you know, year prior to that, I was always struggling to keep up. And that night I was playing, and I kicked it off faster, and he was struggling to keep up with me. And it was like this awareness of, wow, I didn't realize to what extent that my fingers were losing their agility because of the inflammation and how better it had gotten.
Yeah, to
in
what
that
extent you had
time.
Done well. Wow.
So my mom, very shortly after me, she had to go. She decided to go gluten free in order to help her with some problems, issues she was having with her heart. I had about 2 weeks of, oh, man, no more pizza. Well, how can I make pizza without wheat? Oh, man, no more biscuits. Well, how can I make biscuits without? She was just like, I don't have anything to eat. What am I going to do? So we, I was starting to think of this whole thing of, you know, making different things. And I'd been over to BB's to see what they were making. And I remember on Facebook one day, it was Anna's birthday, and she said, he said, you're coming here for some gluten-free treats. And I said, no, she's coming to my house for gluten-free biscotti. I had no clue how to make biscotti. No clue at all. But I knew I liked to dunk things in my coffee, and I had to have something that was gluten-free, or I was just going to be one sorry, sad coffee drinker. So I looked up a recipe, and I had already tried a different one in New Orleans. It was an epic fail. But I looked up a recipe, and I looked at it, and I thought, I bet if we do this, 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 we can make it work. And I made it, and it worked. And so then I thought, now what can I do? Because my mom wasn't – she couldn't have cinnamon sugar. And I was thinking, what can I make for her that she can keep with her in the car? And she loved almonds, so I made an almond flavor. And it came out pretty good, and she liked it. And it just was a matter of – you know, it's to me, it's the same thing as theme and variations.
You see, that's what I'm curious about, mm-hmm. if there's a relation between creating mm-hmm. that to creating – So go more with
so,
that.
Yeah, so once I had a basic recipe that worked, it was changing out the flavors, whether it be vanilla, almond, or now I have I'm working on a pina colada which has orange extract or lemon extract. So there's actually four different extracts that I use. And it was a matter of now what would taste good with those base flavors, and then changing out some of I use almond meal and pecan meal and hazelnut meal, interchanging based on what flavor I'm doing. And so we started making these, and people would have them, and they really would enjoy them. And there wasn't this whole thing of, well, I can tell it's gluten-free. They said, well, it's kind of crumbly, but yet I can dunk it, and it stays together. Or I can eat it without the coffee, and it doesn't hurt my teeth because it's so dense.
Yeah.
I have 12 flavors now.
And I think you have 12 flavors, but the most important thing about that is what's happened with
yes.
your fingers.
Yes, I mean I'm practicing the guitar, the violin, the piano. I'm sitting, and I don't ever, at any point, have to stop because my hands are hurting or they're aching.
Yeah,
I have to stop because I need to go to bed.
But I love the whole relation too of how your brain works.
Mm-hmm.
You know that your brain is able to think in those terms of the kind of the experimental way mm-hmm. of creating those food items to. Some of that experimental way of how you would put things together on an instrument,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I think probably that ability comes directly from having a piece of music and being able to break it down and learn it bit by bit, put it back together, and working with the music degree, we took orchestration and transcribing, and so we would take like a solo instrument, and we'd put it into orchestra form. Well, what would sound good here? What would sound good here? What would sound good here? And pulling in the instruments to get this layer of texture that
That's
was
really
pleasing to the ear that had balance.
Yeah.
I was telling a friend of mine on the Derby team, I said, you know, artistry is the same. It's all about balance, perspective, depth, color. It's just how you are portraying it. For me, it's either audible or edible. For her, it's visual and tangible,
yeah,
three-dimensional. And she's like, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. I was like, well, it's kind of a neat – it's very freeing when you get to that point of, oh, it is art. It's just a different way of expressing it.
That's right. Well, you know, we're going to need another show because
yes.
we didn't get to half of the things that I really wanted to talk. Esther, because you're really an interesting human being
Thank
on
you.
So many levels. I want to talk, though, in the last couple of minutes we have, you're also involved in a musical theater production
yes.
that the final weekend is this weekend at Cite,
yes.
and that's in His Grace.
Yes. It's an amazing play. Jane Beaudeau wrote all of the music, and when we were playing with Jump at the Dog, I didn't even know she played. It was with Jean, And she would come with these songs and she'd say, I wrote this song. What do you think about it? And anyway, so over the course of the last, what, 5, 6 years, she's been putting these songs together and eventually got this whole play that they wrote the book to. And thankfully, she heard me say I wanted to play the bass. But this one song that we're going to play is when I'm playing the violin.
All right. So
come and see it last weekend.
It has been a thrill having Esther Tyree here, the proprietor of Bayou Biscotti, and to find out more about Esther Tyree, her music and her writings at mymusicventures.com. Look for her on a stage or kitchen near you.
Or speaker.
That's right, or speaker. And this is from In His Grace, which is at Cité des Arts this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Thanks, Esther. Everybody have a good week.
Thank you.
When your world is torn apart, only darkness in your heart, don't despair, He's there, and He knows, yes, He knows, when you don't know where to turn, and your bridges have been burned, there is hope. Just believe, 'cause He knows, yes, He knows, when the waters start to climb, and you're drowning in your tears.
Greetings, I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM KRVS.
Hello, I'm Georges Collinet.
And I'm Nadia Raymond.
Here we are in 2013.
And we bring you great new sounds coming out of Latino America, artists to look out for, and new songs to boogie into a fantastic 2013.
Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.